I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. No one could ever quite believe what Niccolò Paganini could do with his violin, the famed Italian virtuoso, standing alone on a stage in the early 1800s and playing a tender passage, caused people to burst into tears. Once, when he was flying through some fierce and complicated piece at a performance in Vienna, a man in the audience leapt to his feet, shrieking he could see the devil on stage with Paganini. That accusation stuck. No human could be that good without having made some sort of deal with the dark force. But aficionados knew something else. They knew that Paganini's violin was no ordinary instrument. It was, in fact, among the finest ever made by Guarneri del Gesu himself. And Paganini knew that the violin was special. He named it Il Canone, the canon, for its amazing sound. And even he considered it such a magical extension of his own being that he once wrote after a poor performance, "The violin is angry with me." Paganini died 163 years ago, and ever since that time, his violin, the violin, Guarneri's Il Canone, has rested in a vault under the care of the city of Genoa, under the eye of the Institute of Paganinian Studies and a committee of classical music experts. And only every once in a while is a highly regarded classical musician selected to play Paganini's violin. And so you can just imagine the Genoan eyebrows arching when it was suggested that the jazz violinist, the American Regina Carter, might be the next invited to play. In fact, the recording that we're listening to now is from a new disc by Regina Carter. It's called Paganini, After a Dream. And the piece that we're listening to is Après un rêve by the composer Gabriel Fauré. It is Regina Carter on Paganini's violin. Now, Connection listeners, why is it still so hard for the violin to be recognized for the jazz instrument that it is? Is it an instrument constrained by its classical roots? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour is the violinist Regina Carter. Thanks so much for coming to the program. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I guess it was a little difficult to actually get your hands on that instrument. You went through a lot of bureaucratic nonsense?
Yes, very much. Several months of it. And actually, my pianist, Vanna Gehrig, and a friend of his who's from Genoa, Andrea Liberovici, came up with this radical idea that I should play on Paganini's violin. And they finally convinced the mayor of Genoa, the other politicians, the Paganini Institute, Paganini Commission, and the rest of the community. And
now, you're being modest. You had some work to do. I understand you even took Italian lessons and made a little speech on your behalf.
I was cramming in because I wanted to, it was such a huge gift for me to be able to play this violin. And I wanted to thank the Italians. And I wanted to do it in their language. And so, yes, I learned a full speech and I memorized it and gave this speech in Italian. And it really, it was very touching for them just to see. I was very sincere. I can't even express, even hearing you just now tell the story again, it was just, it took me right back to that time. And it's truly a fairy tale.
Yeah, it is that. And I was trying to figure out what was in the head of the Italians who were not too crazy about this. And so we went back to one of your earlier discs, and maybe we can just a little. This is from the debut CD, Regina's debut CD. Let's hear it. I could just see them in Genoa putting that up on a CD player. No.
Right. Exactly.
But you had to make a case that was in part built on your own classical musical knowledge of Paganini himself. You were able to make a case
right.
that what you do wasn't a whole lot different from what he did.
Right, because Paganini was an improviser. And so I felt like I was taking the violin full circle. And music is music. Notes are notes. You know, when it comes down to it, if I played jazz on this instrument, it wasn't going to explode. And because I know the history of Paganini, I know the history of this violin, I know how delicate it is and that it's a national treasure, I'm not going to go in and try and play some hardcore Latin music on it or even play Coleño, which is taking the back of the bow and tapping on the strings. I know better than that. And I also think they were afraid because someone had pulled up a picture of me on the internet with a pickup on the violin. And they said, no, absolutely not. You can't put a pickup on this instrument. And I said, I'm not going to do that. Trust me, I know the history. So they sent a whole questionnaire. Who have you studied with? What are some of the pieces you've played? Where did you go to school? What kind of violin? What kind of chin rest? What kind of strings? What kind of this, that, and the other? I had to really convince them that, you know, I come from your world, you know, so it's okay.
So because you come from that world, you knew exactly what you were doing when you laid your hands on that violin. Can you take me back to the moment when someone handed it to you, or did you lift it out of the case?
No, how did that happen? No, the violin keeper, Pio Montanaro, I think was his last name, he handed me the violin. And at first I couldn't touch it because I was so afraid. I mean, here's this priceless instrument, this instrument that Paganini himself had been playing and had owned, and just it was too much for me. And I just stood there looking at it like a deer caught in the headlights. And then he finally again gestured to me like, here, take it. And I did the number one sin: you don't touch instruments on their body because the oils from your hand wear down the varnish, and especially on an instrument that's 250 years old. And I touched it there, and he was like, no, no, with his finger here. And I was like, oh, my God.
So you can only hold a violin by the neck.
You should hold it like a baby, so support the head and the bottom. But on mine, of course, I do everything that you're not supposed to do. So
are there ghosts in that Paganini instrument?
I mean, think so.
It's got the sweat from his chin.
Yeah.
It's got the sweat from the palm of his hands on the neck. I don't know whether or not you feel that when you hold the instrument.
I felt like I did. I mean, in fact, I felt like the instrument itself had a personality living in it. And when I first, any instrument, if it hasn't been played for a while, it's like when a person wakes up in the morning and you try and sing as soon as you wake up, you can't do it. You're groggy. You have to warm up your voice. So you have to warm up the instrument as well. But sometimes I try and play things and I swear to you, the violin would growl at me. And so I had to try and learn in 4 hours, basically, okay, the violin was training me and what I can and can't do. And I have to remember what's going to be possible on this instrument in order for me to get through this concert.
I want to play one of the pieces from the new disc. This one's called Reverie, perhaps, I don't know, the jazziest piece on it. And one of the reasons why I want to listen to it is that it's got that killer solo in the center of it. And we'll make sure that we get to that part of it. But you had the performance about a year and a half ago.
Right.
And then you went back a year ago to record.
Right.
How did you choose, for example, a song like River? How did you decide what it was you were going to play?
Well, the community told me, the community of Genoa, said the music has to match the instrument. So that meant classical music, if you will. I'm using that word loosely.
Yeah.
And there have been so many records where people have tried to fuse the two worlds together and it sounded really corny. So I said, what am I going to do? And John Clayton, who's a great bassist and composer, said, you should check out the French Impressionist composers because they hung out a lot with jazz musicians.
So Debussy, Fauré,
yeah,
this is where you came up with these guys.
Yeah, and you hear the influence in the harmonies. And so it was easier to bridge those two worlds together. And there was so much material. I listened. We spent days listening together. And if something really struck me emotionally, then I said, this is what I have to record.
All right, let's have a listen. This is Regina Carter on Paganini's violin. The song is Reverie by Debussy. Thank you. Did you win them over? Did you convince them that good jazz and a wickedly good violin is a nice combination?
Actually, yes. The interesting thing is that the violin makers, two of them who sat through the session, said afterwards that I caused less stress to the instrument than a classical player, because in order to play jazz on the violin, you have to use a much lighter bow stroke and much less bow. So there's not as much stress as when you're playing classical music and it's very passionate and lots of bow and lots of pressure on the instrument. So points for me. Yay.
Tell me though, whether or not the instrument, I mean, you're here with your violin and a few moments from now, I'd like to ask you to show us a few things. But when you get your hands on something like Paganini's instrument, do you play better? Does it sort of raise the level of your game? Do you know what I mean?
You know what? I didn't feel like it made me play better, only because in the concert I was so nervous. I mean, I've got armed guards with me all the time, even on stage during the performance. You know the history of this violin.
Did they think you were going to run up one of the aisles with it and sell it in a pawn shop?
I guess so. You know, I always think about the red violin, but, you know, I felt like I was really intimidated.
Yeah.
With it then, but during the recording, I think because I had many days with it and I was able to relax with it, and it was my second meeting with it, I felt like I was able to relax with it. But you just have to know what you can and can't do with that instrument. And I think if you know that beforehand, then it's easier. Did it make me play better? I think it inspired me.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely inspired me.
And your playing was a little bit different because you know that you're going to get a different sound out of
right.
this instrument.
Right, yeah, you know. And the context of the music and everything, you know. So whatever situation you're in is going to change how you play.
This also is from that new disc. This player, Regina Carter, that violin, Paganini's violin, Cinema Paradiso. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to talk a little bit more when we come back about that curious nexus between jazz and classical music, particularly as it pertains to the violin. We'd like to hear from you, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other NPR stations.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, and this is Alexandra. It's an original composition by Regina Carter. It's from her new CD, Paganini, After a Dream. Connection listeners, Regina Carter's in the studio with me. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the state of jazz violin, as you know it, the difficulties of breaking through some of those barriers and stereotypes in the music world. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Did you have to twist a few arms to get permission to play one of your own pieces on it if they were saying, oh, no, that's got to be classical?
No, actually, I just sent them a list of what I was doing and more tunes than that, and they were okay with it, I think, because the bulk of it was music by composers that they were very familiar with. So so for that, they were okay. It was interesting, though, because when I recorded the album live in New York with my band, with my violin, and then I flew over to Italy and had to re-record all the violin parts using the Canon. And so they couldn't hear anything. The people from the community that would come in, they could only hear me. And so they weren't sure what was going on, what the record was. And they didn't hear it until I sent them the finished product. And I got letters back from everyone there saying, you know, we were shocked because we didn't know what it was going to be, but it's very beautiful. And I'm very pleased with it, and I'm pleased that they're pleased with it, and that they felt like they could trust me and saw that I really respected the instrument and the music, and that I just turned out, I think, an artistic record. I think, anyway. So,
I wanted to ask you about that because I just can't imagine how you would give yourself the freedom to do the improvisation that a classical piece allows in New York, and then go over to Italy and do it standing alone in a studio with the music from New York in your ear, but then laying down the violin track all over again. That sounds enormously difficult.
It's very difficult because the thing about it is the band reacted, we reacted to each other because we're alive. Now what I have to do, I had to listen to the music and remember that, okay, in this tune here, they reacted to me doing this. So now I had to second guess, if you will. I had to remember that, okay, they're going to react to something in measure five. So in measure four, I have to play something that makes sense. So that people don't say, well, why did the rhythm section play that? And it's interesting because I realize then sometimes we'll be listening to things on the radio and we'll say, and we'll question, why did that drummer play that? Or why did this person?
Right.
And it doesn't make sense. And what I realize now is a lot of times people will overdub their solos and they're not thinking about, okay, the rhythm section reacted to something else. So it's a really... it's a really dangerous thing to try and do, but since I knew going in, I tried to really make a lot of mental notes and then and just react, or what is it? You're not reacting, but setting up.
Anticipating.
Yeah, anticipating. Yeah.
Now, this sort of brings us to the part where I'm curious about where classical music ends and jazz begins, because you then had to do the recording with the canon, Paganini's violin, without any kind of real latitude to say, let me just go in this direction for a bit, as you might if you were live on the stage with your band. And that to me, and I'm not too bright about things like this, brings it closer to music off the page, which doesn't give you any of that kind of freedom, which is where I see classical music.
Right.
Is that an accurate way of looking at it?
Yeah, it was a little bit constraining, you know, because now the recorded music, the band, that became a boundary to me. And because they're not there live, so they're not going to move. So you only have this much room to move within that circle. And knowing the violin is only going to react to this, it's not going to react to that. This isn't going to work, this will work. Having to kind of remember all of that. And also with this music that I chose, okay, what will work with this? You know, I don't think you can just say, well, I'm just going to do this with this style of music, or I'm going to try this with this, if it's not live. You could do that live, but I think you have to respect, or I do, where the music is coming from, and within those boundaries, everything has boundaries, you know.
Can you give me a demonstration of this? Because what you're saying is that you start out with the original intention of the classical composer.
Right.
And you were saying earlier in the program that you need to be careful that you don't go too far, that something doesn't become corny. It's like, ooh, what is she doing with that song, right?
Right, yeah. Well, it's interesting because we had a great arranger who understands both worlds. And so if you take... the thing is when I think you're doing a cover tune, if you're doing someone else's tune, is to respect the melody and respect what they wrote. And so like a piece like... So that's the melody. So then when I come back in the second time after a solo, then I can go. I can do what I want to because I've already respected the melody in the first place. But what's interesting, too, is to think of... usually in classical music, when we're learning violin, you think long bows, vibrato, so you go... So if I use that same thing and try and play a jazz piece like, it's
really corny and someone will throw something at you. So you're going to use much less bow, no vibrato. So it's got to... So it's a lighter stroke as well. And then checking out horn players or even vocalists to hear how do you use the vibrato. So maybe you go... And the bow becomes your vocal cord, so you run out of air. And play with the note and the timbre of it and things that we were taught were wrong or you don't want that sound in classical music. I like to experiment with the instrument and find all kinds of different sounds without using, say, an amplifier or some kind of effect. So I can go... So it gets like that feedback kind of thing.
Yeah.
Playing like that or using harmonics. Or pits with the left hand to imitate a Japanese.
Would you have been deported if you'd done that with Paganini?
Oh, please. I didn't even think about doing any of that stuff or the Calegno hitting it with a... I knew not to do any of that. Just stick with playing with the horsehair and, you know. And there's certain things that for me just would not have worked on the instrument. I mean, I was only given such a little amount of time to get to know it. And trying to really play maybe a hardcore kind of a Latin piece for me would not have worked. If I had more time, maybe so. But I respected where the instrument was coming from, and it was basically, the instrument was telling me what it would allow me to do at that time, and so I knew not to push it.
Though, as you were saying earlier, I mean, the instrument was probably pushed way harder by Paganini himself.
Yeah.
I mean, stories of, actually, I was reading last night, what is it, Ricochet Bowing? What's Ricochet Bowing?
It's like, let's see if I can do this today, like... I'm not even good at it, but it's like that whole up bow thing, which I'm not good at. So, but
double stops. What's the
two
double?
Two notes at one time.
Okay, all right.
Or three notes.
This guy had actually some kind of skeletal degenerative disease that made his wrists flexible, right? So he could do things that
no one else could play. And so people thought he had a pact with the devil and they threatened to burn him or hang him. And he was just such a showman, you know, and he worked the crowds. And it was written that he would break all the strings on his violin on purpose so that he was left with one string and he would play these very difficult pieces on one string. So he was such a showman. And, It's just really interesting when people were really afraid of what I was going to do. It's like, well, let's think about what Paganini himself was doing before he started to give me the riot act.
He'd be playing jazz if he was with us today,
wouldn't
he? I think
so. I think a lot of those musicians would be playing jazz. And it's really interesting because I had done an interview and someone wrote into the Paganini Institute to their website and said they were really perturbed with Genoa for letting me play the violin that was supposed to be reserved for white males and that and I had made some comment about Paganini being a Baroque musician. And for me saying, and he was born exactly after the Baroque period, but he was still an improviser. Just because you're born after that period is over doesn't mean that period or that idiom or that style is dead. If that were the case, we wouldn't be playing bebop today or, you know, any of those styles. And it was just really interesting. He was so hung up on that. And it was like, but Paganini was an improviser. It doesn't matter when he was born. He was playing the style of music where his cadenzas were improvised. And so let's get over all of that. You know, it didn't hurt the instrument then. It's not going to hurt it now.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to our phone lines. Harold's joining us from Quincy. Harold, our jazz conscience here. How are you?
Hey, how are you? Welcome to Boston, Regina.
Thank you very much.
The first time I ever saw you live was quite a few years ago when you performed at the Boston Globe Jazz Festival.
Give the woman a break. Quite a few years ago, she was, you know, wearing white knee socks.
Well, it was, though, in your travels in the world of jazz, wasn't it?
Right, it was, actually.
And, you know, the music you were playing naturally was not hitting on me, but your solo did. And I knew then that you were going to be coming here, where you are today. And what can I say about early music of jazz? I mean, Stuff Smith and Ray Nance and Stefan Grappelli. You can tell Dick that the violin has been live and well in jazz for 50, 60, 70 years.
Okay, but Harold, let's line up the sax players on one side and the violin players on the other side and see whose team wins here. Now,
Well, the fame of the soloist, needless to say, falls within the front line. But let's go to Tartini's Devil's Trill. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
I have an image, because I'm a print collector, of Tartini sleeping in a bed with a devil perched at the edge of his bed with a glare in his eye with a fiddle.
Right.
And it's from France in the 18th century, so it's magnificent.
Right.
We just got through with our early music festival, and they did a whole series of Bieber's sonatas, the Biblicals, Scordatura. Are you familiar with those?
No, I'm not.
Write the name Bieber down if you want to dig 17th century jazz improvisation. Find Heinrich Bieber.
B-E-B-E-R?
B-I-B-E-R.
Okay.
Early music, original instrument.
Right, thank
you. Just like that axe that you had.
let me go back, though, if I can.
Let me finish, please, Richard, because I have a few thoughts. And if
Harold, you're going to have to be brief.
I will be brief. I'm going to come down to see you at Scholars.
Thank
your interpretation of Monk is magnificent, because he's my God. And you are on a spiritual journey, and as the Duke said, we love you madly.
Thank you so much.
I'll see you tonight.
Great,
baby.
Thank you. I look
forward
to meeting you.
Bye.
What is it, though, about the profile of the other instrumentalists in jazz that does, I mean, Harold's right. Stefan Grappelli is a god,
right.
and stands as tall as anyone else in jazz. But there aren't a whole lot of other people with the same profile.
Right. I don't know what it is about the instrument. I think the industry is still really afraid of the instrument, and we have to fight so hard. And I remember when I went to college, they said to me, there's no such thing as jazz violin. I said, yes, there is. I know three of them, you know, at least. And so now, fortunately enough, there's the IAJE, International Association of Jazz Educators Strings Caucus, with their jazz string players from around the world that have gotten together and said, hey, you know what, we're going to have a voice here. It's still really difficult, but now they've managed to have their jazz programs in a lot of colleges, conservatories for string players, and a lot of elementary and secondary schools are starting to introduce string players to jazz at a very early age, which we really, really need. But I don't know. I don't know why people just think violin can't swing, it can't do this. If you put on the Stuff Smith record, I'm sorry. He's holding his own, you know.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Providence, Rhode Island, Ben's joining us. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Good. I just wanted to point out that, you know, most of my friends who are in music school now study classical and jazz, and that what makes them similar is that they're both really hard.
Right.
And they require the kind of old school study and time and practice and studio sessions and stuff like that that a lot of modern music doesn't require. There's nothing wrong with rock or any of these other kinds of music either, but you can learn how to play rock guitar in 2 weeks. And you can't learn how to play classical or jazz, violin, or any other instrument in that time. And so I think that in terms of, I don't think that most young people studying music seriously now see the kind of boundaries between classical and jazz in terms of what it requires skill-wise or technique-wise.
Well, you know what's really interesting is that you're right, because when I was in school, a lot of colleges would say, okay, you have to study your classical music for the first year. You can't study jazz until your second or your third year. But there are still not as many, that gap is closing, thankfully, but there's still some musicians, and I think because still some people teach that one music is better than the other, or a higher music, or an educated people's music. And so once in a blue moon, I still run into musicians that have this kind of snobbery. Even like we play a lot with orchestras, and sometimes the members in the orchestra are just so disrespectful
to what we're doing. And it's really sad to see that. But I'm hoping, like you said, with them now teaching both side by side, that we'll lose a lot of that old way of thinking.
I hope so. I mean, yeah. It's surprising to hear that. I hope so. I mean, I'm also thinking about things like Yo-Yo Ma and Bobby McFerrin, mm-hmm. with that Hush album, or Quentin Marsalis. And even though these are higher profile guys, I don't know as much about the sort of day-to-day musicians who are playing jazz and classical, but certainly those people have made great albums and great strides and great records in all kinds of musical genres, and you would think that, you know, music is music.
Right, exactly, and hopefully with people of that stature will help other people to realize, okay, if Yo-Yo Ma is doing it, then it must be okay, you know, and they'll accept it. So I'm glad that they're... that people are just stepping over boundaries and kind of washing them away.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, when you were saying, you know, the committee does this and the school does this, I was going, but where's that going to bring the audience? But Ben makes the point that if you're training the musicians, the people who we will be looking up to and listening to in the years ahead, to regard jazz with the same respect as classical music, as it sounds like they are, then that's a big step.
It's a giant step. And you know what? Both genres need it. We need audiences. But it used to be that, you know, that we felt like jazz was the only music losing its audience. But everyone is now. So it's like, what are you going to do? You're going to join forces.
Connection listeners, a little bit of Black Orpheus from the Paganini After the Dream new CD by Regina Carter to take us out. And we're back after the break to talk more about jazz and classical music. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other...
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. This hour we're talking with Regina Carter, jazz violinist, classical violinist. Hell, she's just a violinist. Where does that violin live in the musical spectrum of your life? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. This is a piece rather composed by your pianist partner, Vanna Gierig. Did I say his name right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
You guys worked well together. It's quite clear listening to this one.
Yeah, we've been working together for 8 years now. And he came into the band as a sub, and immediately his first gig was with me at the Boston Globe. And... just such a great personality and great musician, and we clicked right away. And it's just really nice to be able to, my whole band is really like a family to me, and to be able to write music together and take music apart and rearrange it. And it's such a joy, you know. And that's what music should be, an experience on the road. And so I feel like I'm very fortunate.
Because you spend a lot of time on the road.
Oh, yeah.
Holy smoke. What, 8 months a year touring?
Yeah, pretty much. When I go home, my neighbors say, you still live here?
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go back to our lines to Columbia, South Carolina. Marjorie's joining us. Hi, Marjorie.
Morning.
Thanks
what
for calling.
Treat. What a pleasure. Mm-hmm. I'm such a big fan.
Thank
my
you.
My father introduced me to Ray Nance and those fellas back in the 50s when I was a child, made sure that I had a chance to hear Nance and Smith and the rest of them.
Wow.
So I am a fan of what you're doing now.
Thank
I'm curious
you.
About your early influences and whether or not Detroit was an important place to be for you as a child and listening to music.
Detroit was had a huge impact on me. I'm so fortunate that I grew up there. When I started playing music, my mom, I was studying, of course, European classical music, so mm-hmm. I didn't hear any jazz. We didn't listen to jazz in my house. So my influences then were Itzhak Perlman, who I had master classes with, and Yehudi Menuhin.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a teenager, though... someone had given me recordings of Jean-Luc Ponty, Stephan Grappelli, and Noel Pointer.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my introduction to jazz. And then I had a girlfriend. I have a girlfriend, a vocalist, Carla Cook, who would come to school every day in high school talking about Eddie Jefferson, Sarah Vaughan. It's like, who are these people? So when we were 16, she took me to my first live jazz concert to hear Stephan Grappelli. And that's when I was really, I said, okay, this is what I want to do. So from then, it was such a journey to like explore this new world that I was introduced to. And then, of course, I would go to jazz clubs and hang out. And just Detroit was a place where people migrated from all over the world because of the automotive industry and Motown. And so we had jazz, Motown, classical music, Latin music, Greek, everything there. And those, I heard all that music. I was exposed to it. And I think now it comes out a lot in my playing. And I feel really fortunate to have grown up in such a great city.
There's one from Motor City Moments, Marjorie. That's Stevie Wonder's Higher Ground. And, and I don't know if you know that disc, but that's kind of an homage to...
To Detroit,
exactly.
Yeah.
The CD with Kenny Barron is my church every morning.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate that.
Marjorie, thanks a lot for calling. Because Detroit, boy, I mean, you can go into any club, and I mean, go back to Motown.
Mm-hmm.
Who were the? What's the name of the gang who were the backup players for the Funk Brothers? We did a piece with them, the backup band for all the Motown singers, and they were sort of like throwing these doors open on what was happening in that city. Unbelievable.
Yeah, and they were jazz musicians.
Exactly.
You know, so it's Beans Bowles and Pistol Allen, and they just did the movie Standing in the Shadows of Motown.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, those musicians. So it wasn't about being a Motown musician or a jazz musician or this. You were just a musician, and you played all that stuff.
And is that a comfortable space for you to want to be now, to not be a classical violinist or a jazz violinist or a fusion violinist, but a violinist?
Yeah, I consider myself just to be a violinist. But, of course, you know, I'm a product as well, so I have to have a
selling
label.
Selling units. <isn't
it>? Yep. So I have to have my... my label, which is okay, but I don't put myself in a box. I try everything.
1-800-423-8255. Back to the phones now to Durham, North Carolina, and Karen's with us. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to say that years ago, I was an usher at an Artist of the Cutting Edge concert series in La Jolla, California, and someone told me that we were going to have a jazz violinist that evening, and I was like, what is that? And I just thank you so much for just knocking my socks off. That was one of the most remarkable evenings of music I've ever seen. I have followed you.
Wow.
Well, not literally followed you.
You're not being stalked.
All right.
Yeah, no, I don't stalk. But I've definitely enjoyed your career since then. And whenever I get an extra bit of change, I buy up your CDs whenever I can. So I'm definitely looking forward to this new one.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I just want to wish you the best of luck and keep up the good work. Keep playing.
Thank you. And thank you for supporting
me. Hey, Karen, before you go away, question for you. I mean, you have this conversion when you hear it, and I'm wondering if you just in you know, conversation with your friends can shed any light on what Regina and I were talking about earlier in the program, why it is that people are still discovering something that is as cool to listen to as it is.
I think it's not as it's becoming, well, I mean, it's being played a lot more on jazz stations, but when was that? That was maybe 10 years ago.
Mm.
When I first heard Regina, I'd never heard it before. And I'd never heard of jazz violinists. It was just, you know, not one of the instruments that worked its way into the repertoire that I was hearing on jazz stations. And so I think that's primarily what it is. I think once people hear it, absolutely, it kind of makes sense. But because we don't hear it, or we hear it now more so, but back then we weren't hearing it at all.
Right.
So it was just this sort of disconnect, a sense that, you know, there are some instruments that are reserved for certain types of music,
right. Yeah.
You know. So,
Regina, is the resistance in your view from the audience based in part on ignorance, just not having heard it?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely. Because some people will come and they'll say, well, we read about you in some magazine. We're just coming to check you out. We don't know your music, but we've never heard of jazz violin. Right. And afterwards, they're like, oh, okay, you can play jazz on that. But I think it's just because they haven't been exposed to it. And I think the industry, still record companies, think that there are certain instruments that won't sell. Violin, they don't think violin, trombone, drums as a frontline instrument.
Yeah.
So as long as they feel like that, and it's really difficult for us to get a disc out, well, now you could do it yourself, but still you have to have an avenue. Where is it going to be played? Who's going to hear
it? But inside the jazz community, I mean, if you've got a bass player and a pianist and a sax player, and you walk in with the little axe and say,
right,
can I play with you guys? It's like, are they saying, well, really not too sure how it's all going to fit together, or are people who know jazz, you know, wide open to it?
No, I mean, when I first moved to New York, I went to a jam session there, and I signed up, and my name kept being passed over, and I just kept bugging them, can I sit in? And the musician said, what's she going to do with this little violin? And I was really appalled, you know. And coming from Detroit, where musicians like Marcus Belgrave and Lyman Woodard, all these great musicians, didn't care what I played. The fact that I wanted to play this music was what was important to me. I was really shocked by that comment. But I haven't experienced that too much from musicians. And I think now there are more of us. So it's still a struggle, though. It's still really a struggle.
You were saying earlier that you like to write and that Vanna likes to write. Is that going to be a larger part of your career in the years ahead? Is it important to be producing your own music?
It is important so that I can be documented, and it is a way to make money. That's your only way. I don't make money on record sales. And just because it's something that I really enjoy doing, I haven't done a lot of it. I wrote Alexandra.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big commission piece. It was commissioned by the Kennedy Center, and then I was commissioned by a classical string quartet, the Elements Quartet, to write a piece for them. So it's something that's not very comfortable still for me, but I'd like to pull the rug from under my own feet and try. And once I get into it, I really enjoy it. So it's something that I want to do more of. And I think Van and I are great writing partners. We've even done some commercials, you know, written some music for commercials. So it's something that I do want to do more of. It's just difficult because I spend so much time on the road and playing that I don't have that time to sit down and write.
Yeah, time to relax. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Let's take our last call from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. David's on the line. Hi, David.
Hi, David. Hi, good afternoon. Good morning, rather.
Thanks for calling, David.
I'm interested in who are some of the young people or the newer generation of musicians who are using the violin to explore jazz. It's something that I've not heard a great deal about. I've heard one of your callers talk about some of those heroes, I guess, of this who were here many, many years ago. But who are some of the other folks? Who are your contemporaries today that you listen to?
Whose discs are you buying?
Well, Mark Feldman is one. Mark O'Connor, Karen Briggs. A lot of people are more familiar with Karen because she plays with Yanni, but she's a great jazz violinist. Mary Benari. Matt Glazer, Daryl Anger, the Turtle Island String Quartet, Akua Dixon, who's a cellist, jazz cellist that has Quartet Indigo, Marlene Rice. Oh, my God. There's so many. My brain is just going.
See, it's kind of an interesting contrast because, and I know that you know who all these people are, but there are hundreds, there are thousands, and the names certainly don't come to our minds,
mm-hmm,
as readily. I mean, you can reel them off.
Right, but a lot of it is because I'm out here working in the industry, and of course I'm going to know people that are playing my instrument. Some of these people don't have recordings out, or they're recording with other people. And so if you can't go to the store and readily see, oh, here's a whole bin of just jazz string players, you're not going to know about them. And if they don't have a disc out, or, you know, if it's not being played on the radio, how are you going to really know? You have to really search hard to find us. So we're out here. You just have to do a little little research, you know.
David, thanks a lot for your call. I'm interested, Regina, to know if after having played Il Canone, the canon, Paganini's violin, the violin that you play now, you pick it up and you go, oh, it's like the dress I didn't want to wear today, you know?
Well, it was like that when I finished the concert in Italy and they wanted me to do an encore. I had to do it because my 45 minutes on that violin were up. So I had to do it on my violin. And when I even grabbed my violin, it felt so incredibly small because it's a lot smaller than the Canon.
Just physically it's smaller.
Yeah, it's a lot smaller. And I went to play and there was no sound. I was like, what happened? What did they do to you? But it
was hurt its feelings. That's the problem.
Right. It was really difficult to go back to my instrument. Now, of course, I'm playing it all the time. I'm used to it. But when you make that switch right away, it's really depressing. I'm sorry. But
you'll make it up later.
Right.
Tonight at a concert. Incidentally, Connection listeners, for information about where Regina Carter is playing, information about the new CD, stories about the Paganini violin, all those links are on our website, so no excuse not to go there and explore more about the music and the story and the woman who's in the studio with me. We're at theconnection.org. And Regina, as we listen to a little more, this is Gabriel Fauré again,
yes.
Is it not?
Pavan, yes.
Pavan, to take us out, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us this morning.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
The guest, my guest, the violinist, Regina Carter. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Support.